16. Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, Washington, D.C., January 20, 1981, 11:47 p.m. Ronald Reagan stares at the elephant in the room. It stands 13 feet tall and measures 27 feet from trunk to tail. It took 13 four-inch bullets to kill him. The Fanyakuvi elephant, as the regal animal is known, is poised for battle in the center of this festive rotunda. Its flanks are draped in patriotic red, white, and blue bunting, making it the very symbol of the Republican Party. At the time of its shooting by Hungarian big-game hunter Joseph Fanyakuvi on November 12, 1955, it was the largest ever African elephant in recorded history. On March 6, 1959, Fanyakuvi donated the preserved hide of the elephant to the Smithsonian, where a team of taxidermists labored for 16 months to prepare it for display. The other symbol of the party stands at a lectern bearing the official seal of the President of the United States of America. Ronald Wilson Reagan gazes out over the hundreds of supporters dressed in formal wear who have come to celebrate his inauguration. He wears white tie and tails. Nancy Reagan, on his right, is draped in a white satin sheath that took a team of dressmakers 4 weeks to embroider. Her full-length Maximilian coat and alligator handbag are backstage, watched over by the Secret Service. Unbeknownst to the crowd, Nancy's outfit for the evening costs close to $25,000, more than $68,000 in today's money. This is the Reagan's 9th inaugural ball of the evening, and with midnight just moments away, they still have one more to go. The festivities began the previous night at the inaugural gala organized by Frank Sinatra. Johnny Carson was the MC, introducing performances by Sinatra and comedian Bob Hope, who poked fun at Reagan's Hollywood days by joking that the new president doesn't know how to lie, exaggerate, or cheat. He's always had an agent for that. Tonight is even more glamorous. Priced at a steep $500 a ticket, seats are in such demand that the press will compare these formally dressed men and women to drunken soccer fans as they battle for their places at the table, where swordfish and Chateaubriand are washed down with California wine and Kentucky bourbon. Hundreds of corporate titans have flown in from all over the country, so many, in fact, that their private jets have disrupted normal flight patterns at Washington's National Airport this morning. As limousines clog the city streets, California socialite and longtime Nancy Reagan confidant Betsy Bloomingdale actually gets out of her stretch limo to direct traffic at DuPont Circle. A mink stole draped around her shoulders, the 58-year-old Bloomingdale doesn't have time for gridlock. Indeed, so many women have worn expensive furs to these inaugural balls that the press will report coat racks looking like giant furry beasts. The Washington caterer Ridgewell's will serve 400,000 hors d'oeuvres at the various parties tonight. Lavish consumption is on display, something Jimmy and Rosalind Carter would never have allowed. Throughout the night, Ronald Reagan remains unfazed. "I want to thank all of you," he tells the crowd at the Smithsonian. His voice is growing hoarse after hours of speeches, but though he is just weeks away from turning 70 years old, the new president shows no sign of fatigue. "Without you, there wouldn't be this successful inaugural." 4 years ago, Jimmy Carter did not feel it appropriate to celebrate his inauguration with even one formal ball, let alone 10. No partying for the man from Plains. Instead, Carter's 1977 inaugural address was somber, pointing out America's limitations as a nation. The tone of pessimism and defeat that marked Carter's first day in office came to define his entire presidency. If Ronald Reagan's first day in office is any indication of what is to come, the United States of America is in for a far more upbeat presidency. He and Nancy spent last night at Blair House, the official state residence where presidents-elect sleep the night before their inauguration. The first couple is rested and ready to take full advantage of the celebration. The Reagans have been in Washington for a week, adapting to the Capitol's routine after more than a year living out of suitcases on the campaign trail. With their new life comes intense public scrutiny. A litany of personal facts is finding their way into the media. Given his age, many wonder about Reagan's health. Despite a medical history that includes a shattered femur suffered in a celebrity baseball game 30 years ago, the worst of his maladies right now is minor arthritis in his right thumb and chronic hay fever. He continues to work out each night using a small exercise wheel before taking an evening shower. To some doctors, for a man about to enter his eighth decade, Reagan is an amazing physical specimen. In fact, the biggest physical problem Reagan has right now might be his hair color. It has become a national mystery. The president says he does not dye his dark hair, but many are skeptical. Gerald Ford once noted that Reagan's hair was prematurely orange. This occasional side effect is often seen as evidence of the use of Clairol hair dye, and in 2009, a former Clairol executive stated to the New York Times that the Reagans brought their own personal hair colorist into the White House. However, it has never been confirmed. There is no question that Ronald Reagan is a vain man. He is almost deaf in his right ear thanks to standing too close to gunfire while filming a series of movies about the Secret Service in the late 1940s. But Reagan refuses to wear a hearing aid. Also, he can get testy at times. Some of his campaign staff whisper about Irish rages. In one case, candidate Reagan became so annoyed with his speechwriters that he took off his glasses and threw them against the wall. Such outbursts are rare, but Reagan's closest confidants know that when they see his jaw tighten, it is time to back off. The Reagans are often pedestrian in their tastes. Reagan's favorite Christmas carol is Silent Night, and his favorite song is the Battle Hymn of the Republic. He enjoys lasagna and hamburgers for dinner, followed by a dessert of brownies or carrot cake. When watching television, the Reagans prefer The Waltons and Little House on the Prairie, shows built around wholesome values. Ronald Reagan's political hero is no longer Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He's been replaced by former Republican President Calvin Coolidge. He, Coolidge, wasn't a man with flamboyant looks or style, but he got things done in a quiet way. Reagan will write of the man whose picture will hang in the White House cabinet room. He came into office after World War I, facing a mountain of war debt, but instead of raising taxes, he cut the tax rate and government revenues increased, permitting him to eliminate the wartime debt. This kind of analysis surprises observers in Washington, many of whom don't think that Ronald Reagan has a first-rate intellect. He has long studied the nuances of domestic and foreign policy and possesses a stunning ability to recollect the most minute facts for the purposes of a speech or debate. But Reagan often hides his knowledge in order to present himself as a simple man of humble opinions, an image he believes makes him more appealing to regular voters. Yet Reagan does not pander. While many politicians use religion as a campaign theme, the Reagans rarely go to church, and the new president does not make an issue out of his belief in God. However, his spirituality does influence him. On October 11, 1979, Reagan sends a letter to a writer for a pro-life Catholic magazine in response to an article about Reagan's views on abortion. "To answer your questions, I have a very deep belief that interrupting a pregnancy means the taking of a human life. In our Judeo-Christian tradition, this can only be justified as a matter of self-defense." But expressions like that for Ronald Reagan are rare. His experience in the secular state of California imbued him with a practical political strategy, so he mostly avoids the emotional issue of religion. Nancy Reagan, on the other hand, avoids very little. She is known to blurt out her personal thoughts. When her son Ron attacks Jimmy Carter as having the morals of a snake, Nancy publicly defends her boy. In December, just 1 month after the election, she stands up against gun control by admitting to owning a tiny little gun. Coming shortly after the assassination of singer John Lennon, the comment strikes many as callous, and there is public outrage over the incident in liberal circles. Reacting to the heat, Nancy fires her newly appointed press secretary for not protecting her from the media backlash. Sensing blood, the press descends on Nancy Reagan. Soon she is being described as being cheap and self-absorbed. Tonight Show host Johnny Carson refers to her as the Evita of Bel Air, comparing her to the imperious wife of Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, Eva, who longed for her own unlimited power. In truth, Nancy Reagan is much more interested in high fashion and copies the dress and look of two icons, Jackie Kennedy and England's Duchess of Windsor. To cover the cost of such extravagance, the incoming First Lady expects designers to give her clothing and handbags gratis, under the pretense that they are merely being borrowed. Nancy Reagan wears one of those outfits now, a $3,000 dress, coat, and hat by the Cuban-born designer Adolfo, as she and Ronald Reagan are driven from Blair House to the White House shortly before noon on Inauguration Day. There they are met by a somber Jimmy Carter and his wife. Per tradition, the two men ride together in a limousine for the short 2-mile journey to the Capitol building for Reagan's swearing-in. They sit side by side in the back seat, but do not speak. Instead, each man looks out the window, waving to the crowds on his side of the limo. "He was polite," Reagan will later write of that stony ride. "He hardly said a word to me as we moved slowly toward the Capitol, and I think he hesitated to look me in the face." Nancy Reagan and Rosalind Carter are driven in a separate limousine directly behind their husbands. Rosalind Carter wears a dull brown skirt and coat with a matching scarf knotted at her throat, making her look somewhat dowdy next to Nancy in her fire engine red outfit. Today is the end of a dream for Rosalind, who grew up poor with a widowed mother who took in sewing to make ends meet. The differences between her and Nancy Reagan with her debutante past and wealthy stepfather are many. Rosalind has attempted to be kind to Nancy throughout the transition, as her husband has been to Ronald Reagan, for the Carters well remember the courtesies extended to them by the Ford family as they were leaving office 4 years ago. However, Nancy Reagan has managed to annoy Rosalind. She has visited the White House several times, intent most of all on gauging the amount of closet space so that her enormous wardrobe will have a home. Mrs. Carter tolerated having Nancy snoop around, even though the White House was still very much the Carter home. But when Nancy requested that the Carter family move out a week before the inauguration, Rosalind drew the line. Her answer was a firm no. The Carters remained the White House's official residence until just a few minutes before noon, on Inauguration Day. Nevertheless, the transition of presidential power is well underway. The recorders who tally every moment of a president's day stopped recording Carter's activities 1 week ago. The Carters' furniture is being removed from the White House, replaced by that of the Reagans. Leaving office is hard on Jimmy Carter, for he is exhausted from staying up all night in a last-minute attempt to free the hostages in Iran. It is an act for which he will receive little credit. The Iranian militants would not set the Americans free until Reagan was sworn in, due to Carter's support for the Shah of Iran. On January 19, 1981, the Algiers Accord resulted in the freeing up of $7.9 billion in Iranian assets that had been frozen by the United States once the hostage crisis began. This paved the way for the hostages' freedom. The Reagans have brought California's weather with them. Tens of thousands of people stand in shirt sleeves and light jackets on this 56-degree day. The crowds stretch from the Capitol building all the way down to the National Mall to the Lincoln Memorial. American flags and red, white, and blue bunting seems to be everywhere, imbuing this day with a jubilant sense of patriotism. Later on, once word gets out about the newly freed American hostages, yellow ribbons will be tied around every available tree, only heightening the festive atmosphere. This American tradition of welcoming home prisoners of war and soldiers was revived by the 1973 song "Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree" by Tony Orlando and Dawn. The practice dates to the 19th century, when American women wore a yellow ribbon to show their faithfulness to a husband or sweetheart serving in the U.S. cavalry. But not everyone is joyful. There are many in the media who despise Ronald Reagan. Terms such as lightweight, B-movie actor, and even dangerous are sometimes used to denigrate him, both privately and in print. Ever since the failed Nixon administration, it has become commonplace in the media to disrespect Republican politicians. Despite many preconceived notions and his television persona, the press and most of the American people do not really know Ronald Reagan. He reveals himself to very few people. He is wary of the media and easily guided by the strong personality of Nancy, who has more influence than any of his advisors, though even she is often frustrated by his unwillingness to share his feelings. Ronald Reagan is passive in many ways. He can be stubborn when he chooses to put his foot down, but often allows others to make decisions for him. He craves approval and applause, thanks to growing up the son of an alcoholic father who gave him little of either. He often appears disengaged, preferring the company of his own thoughts to time with family and friends. He is a loyal man, but he has put little effort into fatherhood, often ignoring his children when they need him most. Reagan's world revolves around his conservative ideals and Nancy, with whom he has been known to get annoyed, but rarely angry. This is the real Ronald Reagan, but the public man is a far different story. To millions of his supporters, the new president is a benign father figure, a man who makes them proud to be Americans, and Reagan himself is proud of that image. Vice President George H.W. Bush is sworn in first. The choice of running mate was a savvy move on Reagan's part, as it was Bush who proved the toughest opponent during the 1980 Republican presidential primaries. A longtime party workhorse, the World War II bomber pilot has served as a congressman from Texas, envoy to China, director of Central Intelligence, and chairman of the Republican National Committee. At 6'2", he stands an inch taller than Reagan and shares a similar athletic background. His eyes are blue, and he adds styling mousse to his gray-brown hair to keep it in place. Poppy, as he was nicknamed in his youth, is known for being a gentle yet tough man. Bush now steps into the thankless role of vice president with the same aplomb he brought to each of his previous jobs. Reagan has plans to make great use of George Bush and his many skills in a manner normally unseen between a president and a vice president. Unlike Reagan, who can be privately aloof, Bush makes friends easily. He still keeps in touch with schoolmates and Navy buddies he met decades ago. The same holds true in Washington, where Bush is deeply connected inside the Beltway. Reagan's practical side will not allow him to let such qualities go to waste. At the stroke of noon, the new vice president steps away from the lectern. It is now Ronald Wilson Reagan's turn to take the oath of office. He wears a gray vest and tie under his black suit as he places his hand on a Bible that once belonged to his mother. A poised Nancy Reagan is at his side, resplendent in her matching red dress, coat, and hat. In what is a political first for Reagan, all four of his grown children are in attendance, standing with the other invited guests just behind him. And in what is a harbinger of things to come, none of the children is smiling. A burst of sunshine plays on Reagan's face as Chief Justice Warren Burger reads him the oath. I, Ronald Wilson Reagan, do solemnly swear. The oath takes just 40 seconds. Reagan relishes each phrase, repeating words for dramatic impact and adding a pause here and there for emphasis. May I congratulate you, sir, the Chief Justice says, reaching over to shake Reagan's hand. As a 21-gun salute echoes throughout Washington, D.C., Reagan kisses his wife on the cheek. They turn together and look out on the thousands of Americans who have traveled to Washington to be here with them in person to witness this historic moment. Tonight there will be fireworks in the nation's capital. In New York, the Statue of Liberty will be bathed in spotlights. For the next 12 hours, Ronald and Nancy Reagan will be celebrated with a dazzling succession of parades, parties, and speeches. Then, finally, will come the humbling moment when Ronald Reagan steps into the Oval Office for the first time. As the most powerful man in the world, Ronald Reagan is preparing himself for the job by bringing in many political veterans. His chief of staff will be James Baker III, a fellow former Democrat who ran the presidential campaigns of Gerald Ford and then George H.W. Bush 4 years later. Reagan is willing to overlook that indiscretion for the sake of an organized and efficient White House. He likes that Baker is a no-nonsense manager known for his crisp analysis. Reagan's deputy chief of staff and the second man in what will become known as the Troika will be Michael Deaver, a member of his California gubernatorial staff and a man whom both Ronald and Nancy Reagan prize for his loyalty. And the third man upon whom Reagan will rely for advice in times of doubt is Edwin Meese, an attorney who served as chief of staff during the California governorship. His official title is counselor to the president, but the 49-year-old Meese's actual job description goes much deeper than merely giving legal advice. He and Reagan know each other so well that Meese is often considered the president's alter ego. However, knowing that such a role can carry too much clout in the White House, Meese has made it a point to meet with Baker in order to sharply define their roles. It is a balance of power that will be tested much sooner than either man is anticipating. Thanks to his capable team, Reagan is confident that he can run the country. He is so eager to begin changing America that this afternoon he will sign his first executive order. With the swipe of a pen, he will order a federal hiring freeze. Within a week, he will also lift price controls on oil and gasoline, simultaneously setting in motion his personal idea of a free market economy and making his many donors from the gas and oil industry billions of dollars richer. It is time for us to realize that we are too great a nation to limit ourselves to small dreams, he preaches in his inaugural address. We are not, as some would have us believe, doomed to inevitable decline. I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing. The last inaugural ball winds down well past midnight. But at 9 o'clock the same morning, Ronald Reagan sits down at the Resolute desk in the Oval Office and scans his list of scheduled meetings. He wears a coat and tie, as he will each and every time he sets foot in this legendary workspace. Reagan is firmly in command, or so it seems to those around him. Little does he know the violence that lies ahead. 17. Stapleton Airport, Denver, Colorado, March 7, 1981, 6 p.m. John Hinckley shuffles off the United Airlines flight from New York, eyes glazed from fatigue and face unshaven. He has spent a week on the East Coast in yet another futile attempt to win Jodie Foster's love. "Dear Mom and Dad," the 25-year-old wrote in a note just 7 days ago, "your prodigal son has left again to exorcise some demons. I'll let you know in a week where I am." But Foster once again rejected Hinckley, and yesterday morning at 4:30, a broke and incoherent Hinckley phoned his parents, begging for a ticket to fly home. He is unaware that Jodie Foster has given his love letters to the Yale University campus police, who are currently launching an investigation into his whereabouts. Hinckley is among the last passengers to disembark. His 55-year-old father, Jack, is waiting. His mother has not made the drive into the city from Evergreen because she is so distraught about her son that she has spent the day sobbing. The entire Hinckley family has been devastated by John's behavior. His sister Diane and elder brother Scott both phoned yesterday to encourage their parents to place John in a mental hospital. "He just keeps going down," Scott Hinckley told his father. "John doesn't seem like he can cope anymore." But coping is the least of it. If Jack and Joanne Hinckley were the sort of people to pry, they would find a handgun, bullets, and paper targets in the shape of a man's torso in a small green suitcase hidden in their son's bedroom closet. But they do not believe in snooping into their son's belongings or his personal business. They have no idea why John impulsively flew back to New York City, and certainly no knowledge of the grandiose scheme to court Jodie Foster. This does not mean that Jack and Joanne are completely hands-off parents. It was through their urging that their troubled son has begun seeing a Colorado psychiatrist about his failing mental health. Dr. John Hopper, however, does not see anything greatly wrong with John Hinckley. In their sporadic sessions together over the last 5 months, Hopper has seen no signs of delusion or other symptoms of mental illness. John Hinckley trusts Hopper enough to confess that he is on the breaking point mentally, but rather than be alarmed, the psychiatrist thinks him a typical socially awkward young man who exaggerates his obsessions. Hopper treats Hinckley by attaching biofeedback electrodes to his forehead and thermometers to his fingers in an effort to teach him relaxation techniques. Relaxation, Hopper believes, is vital to curing Hinckley. The psychiatrist also believes that Jack and Joanne Hinckley are mostly to blame. He believes they coddled their son, not holding him accountable for his behavior. They allow him to live at home and don't force him to find a job. So Hopper has encouraged them to draw up a contract to set in motion the wheels of John Hinckley's independence. By March 1st, he is to have a job. By March 30th, he is to have moved out of the house. Give John $100, Dr. Hopper told the Hinckleys, and tell him goodbye. Dr. John Hopper will be sued by Hinckley's many victims, saying that Hopper should have known he was dangerous and placed him in a hospital. The case was dismissed. Technically, John Hinckley has remained true to the contract. He beat the deadline for finding employment, landing a menial position with the local Evergreen newspaper. But he walked away from that job when he flew to New York. Now, in the busy Denver airport, a heartbroken Jack Hinckley must perform a most gut-wrenching act of parenting. He must tell his son goodbye. Jack Hinckley guides John to an unused boarding gate. "Have you eaten anything?" he asks. "I bought a hamburger in New York and ate again on the plane," John replies. They sit down. Jack is direct, telling his son that he is no longer welcome in their home. "You've broken every promise you've made to your mother and me. Our part of the agreement was to provide you with a home and an allowance while you've worked at becoming independent. I don't know what you've been doing these past months, but it hasn't been that, and we've reached the end of our rope." John Hinckley is shocked. Even at age 25, he is so accustomed to having his parents solve his problems that his father's words stun him. Jack presses $200 into John's hands. "The YMCA is an inexpensive place to live," he says softly. "I don't want to live at the Y." "Well, it's your decision, John. From here on, you're on your own." The two men walk to the airport garage where John Hinckley Jr. parked his white Plymouth Volare 7 days ago. Jack Hinckley has brought along antifreeze, knowing that the car has been sitting in the winter cold all week. He empties the jug into the engine and then stands back as his son turns the key in the ignition. "I watched him drive slowly down the ramp," Jack Hinckley will later write of that moment. "I did not see my son face to face again until we met in prison." 3 weeks later, John Hinckley parks the white Volare in his parents' driveway. He has been living at a dive called the Golden Palms Hotel, 30 minutes away in Lakewood. Jack is at work, so it is Hinckley's mother who answers the door. John is flying to California to start his new life, and Joanne Hinckley has agreed to drive him to the airport. The date is Wednesday, March 25th, 1981. At the same moment, Ronald Reagan is taking advantage of one of the great perks that come with being president, flying by helicopter to Marine Corps Base Quantico, where he will spend 2 hours on horseback. Mother and son barely speak during the hour-long ride into Denver. She does not want him to leave, but forces herself to stick with what she and her husband now call the plan. John parks in front of the Western Airlines terminal. Joanne violates the plan by giving him $100. "He looked so bad and so sad and in absolutely total despair," she will later recall. "I thought he would take his own life." But John Hinckley's flirtation with suicide has passed. He has a very different form of killing on his mind. "Mom," he tells her, saying goodbye once and for all to his former life, "I want to thank you for everything you've ever done for me." Joanne Hinckley knows something is wrong. Her son never speaks with such formality. but the plan must be obeyed, so she overrules her intuition and does nothing to stop John from leaving. If not for the plan, the course of history might have been changed.
"You're very welcome," Joanne tells her son.
Her voice is intentionally cold because she knows she will start sobbing if she lets down her guard. Then, without a kiss or hug or even a handshake, she gets in the Volare and drives away. Little does she know her son is carrying one of his RG-14 22 caliber Saturday Night Specials in his luggage. It has become a vital part of his plan. 18. White House, Washington, D.C., March 3, 1981, 1:22 p.m. Seated inside the diplomatic reception room, President Ronald Reagan makes small talk with CBS anchorman Walter Cronkite as a sound engineer adjusts their lapel microphones. The two men sit opposite each other on simple wooden chairs. Behind them, the iconic Frederick Remington bronze sculpture Bronco Buster perches on a credenza. Reagan's legs are crossed, and he rests his hands on his knees to keep them still as he speaks. Both men are dressed in dark suits, with Reagan's maroon tie in subtle contrast to the blue and yellow favored by the newsman. Walter Cronkite has been a major figure in broadcasting for 40 years, and Reagan has specifically chosen him to conduct his first interview since taking office 6 weeks ago. The anchorman has personally known each president since Herbert Hoover and has an opinion on each. Cronkite finds Reagan to be a lot of fun to be with, the kind of guy you really like to have as a friend. Despite that admiration, Cronkite has a job to do. In this instance, he must ask Reagan tough questions in an attempt to reassure the world that the president does not plan on waging a nuclear war against the Soviet Union. So far, Reagan has done little to dispel that notion, taking the same hard-line stance against the Soviets that he took against communists in Hollywood almost 4 decades ago. The situation has grown worse in the past week. On February 24th, Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev gave a 3-hour speech in front of a Communist Party gathering in Moscow. The 74-year-old Brezhnev is a short, overweight man with enormous bushy eyebrows who has ruled his nation for almost 17 years. During that time, he has pursued a ruthless path of aggression against the United States and the rest of the West, secretly building a nuclear arsenal and military that now dwarf those of America and NATO. This is in violation of several treaties between the two nations designed to keep world peace. Since the Nixon administration, the United States has pursued a policy of détente, in which the Soviet Union has often played the part of the aggressor, and America has usually acceded to its demands in an effort to keep the peace. It is a policy that Ronald Reagan abhors, and he is determined that Brezhnev understand that. "It has been a long time since an American president stood up to the Soviet Union," he says to his son Michael in 1976. "Every time we get into negotiations, the Soviets are telling us what we are going to have to give up in order for us to get along with them, and we forget who we are." Reagan made this comment from his hotel suite during the 1976 Republican National Convention. He was lamenting his loss to Ford and the opportunity to implement his own foreign policy. His words continued, "I wanted to become President of the United States so I could sit down with Brezhnev, and I was going to let him pick out the size of the table, and I was going to listen to him tell me, the American president, what we were going to have to give up. And I was going to listen to him for maybe 20 minutes, and then I was going to get up from my side of the table, walk around to the other side, and lean over and whisper in his ear, 'Njet.' It's been a long time since they've heard 'Njet' from an American president." At the time of Brezhnev's speech at the Kremlin, many within the KGB fear that the Soviet Union can no longer keep up with the United States economically or militarily. A nation can be militarily successful for only so long. At some point, the economy must also be powerful, and this is where the Soviets are failing. The Cold War, that decades-old ideological conflict between capitalism and communism, could soon come to an end, and communism could lose.
For this reason, Brezhnev's speech included an invitation that Ronald Reagan sit down at the negotiating table. Pretending to seek peace, Brezhnev was again bluffing. He wanted to bully the untested American president. But Ronald Reagan is in no mood to be bullied, not by Leonid Brezhnev, nor by Walter Cronkite. From the very first question, Cronkite attempts to put Reagan on the defensive. He asks about the crisis in American foreign policy, drawing comparisons between the United States military advisors in El Salvador and the early days of America's involvement in Vietnam. Reagan fires back in a cordial yet firm tone of voice. "No, Walter," referring to the newsman by his first name, "the difference is so profound." The president continues for a full minute, rattling off the details of the growing communist threat in Central America thanks to military groups controlled by the Russians and Cubans. Cronkite replies with another pointed question about the wisdom of Reagan's foreign policy. Reagan responds instantly, his command of the facts absolute. Back and forth they go for 20 minutes, two master communicators making sure their message is heard. And while Cronkite is speaking to the American people, Ronald Reagan is talking directly to Leonid Brezhnev. Every word of this interview, right down to each comma, will be transcribed and scrutinized in Moscow. Reagan wants the Russians to know one thing above all else. He is not Jimmy Carter. Soon enough, the subject turns to Brezhnev's demand for a summit meeting. "You might have overdone the rhetoric a little bit by laying into the Soviet leadership, calling them liars and thieves," Cronkite states, referring to a comment Reagan made at his first press conference. "The world, I think, is looking forward to some negotiations to stop the arms race, to get off this danger point." But Reagan does not budge. "I do believe this," Reagan begins, distancing himself from a detente that he considers phony. "It is rather foolish to have unilaterally disarmed, you might say, as we did by letting our defensive, our margin of safety, deteriorate. And then you sit with the fellow who's got all the arms. What do you have to negotiate with?" Leonid Brezhnev is not pleased. The Soviet leader sits in his Kremlin office on this cold winter day, craving the cigarettes that doctors are forcing him to quit. The last time he met with an American president was a year and a half ago at the Hofburg Palace in Vienna, Austria. There, after signing an arms control treaty that limited the Soviet Union and United States to the same number of missiles and long-range bombers, a jubilant Brezhnev embraced Jimmy Carter, kissing him on both cheeks. To the millions worldwide watching this display on television, Brezhnev seemed to want to appear both charming and lighthearted. He has the Slavic love of physical contact, backslapping, bear hugs, and kisses, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger wrote in a confidential memo to President Gerald Ford in 1974. His anecdotes and imagery, to which he resorts frequently, avoid the language of the barnyard. His humor is heavy, sometimes cynical, and frequently earthy. Brezhnev is a nervous man, partly because of his personal insecurity, partly for physiological reasons traced to his consumption of alcohol and tobacco, Kissinger continued. "You will find his hands perpetually in motion, twirling his gold watch chain, flicking ashes from his ever-present cigarette, clanging his cigarette holder against an ashtray. From time to time he may stand up behind his chair or walk about. He is likely to interrupt by offering food and drink. His colleagues obviously humor him in these nervous habits." But Brezhnev has a notorious dark side. Until recently, he womanized constantly, despite being married for more than 50 years. Physical ailments, however, have left him bloated and unable to speak without slurring, making sexual liaisons only a memory. His condition is so bad that the television broadcast of his February 24th speech to the Communist Party Congress was suddenly terminated after just 6 minutes. At this point, Brezhnev often seems incoherent, so much so that many Russians now mock him. But they do so secretly. Brezhnev may be in poor health, but he still wields the power to make men disappear into the gulags of snowy Siberia or to vanish altogether.
After Brezhnev overthrew former Soviet dictator Nikita Khrushchev in 1964, sending him into house arrest on a farm outside Moscow, he made it clear that his role model was the ruthless Joseph Stalin, the World War II leader who murdered tens of millions of Russians and foreigners over the course of his brutal 31-year reign. Brezhnev is on a less extreme course. He and his KGB chief, the equally barbaric 66-year-old Yuri Andropov, are fond of imprisoning dissidents and either declaring them insane or sending them to forced labor gulags. There, the prisoners live on thin soup and hard black bread, laboring to chop down trees in temperatures as cold as 70 below zero. Soviet guards are known to shoot them on sight if they attempt to flee the barbed wire ringing their forest prisons. Brezhnev copied the gulags from Joseph Stalin. So far, he has murdered approximately 2 million people in the camps. He is dedicated to Stalin's belief that communism should rule the world, and that all brutality is permissible in this quest. Sensing weakness in the West, Leonid Brezhnev has sent Soviet troops into Vietnam, Egypt, and Afghanistan, and to the Chinese border, and those are just the nations where these forces are in the open. Soviet troops can also be found hidden within Angola, Cuba, Central America, and a host of smaller nations in which Brezhnev plots to spread global domination. Wherever the Soviets go, atrocities follow. The body count extends far beyond military intrusions. In Afghanistan, children are routinely maimed, mutilated, and murdered by a nefarious device known as the butterfly mine. Dropped by Soviet helicopters, millions of these explosive devices flutter to earth like small insects. But when a child tries to capture one of these delicate figures, the liquid explosive inside detonates, instantly severing their hands. Ronald Reagan knows all this and despises the communist leadership. He also understands he has 4, perhaps 8 years to implement his strategy to reduce the Soviet threat. Brezhnev is intent on maintaining power for as long as he lives. He has marginalized his political rivals, keeping them on the fringes of power. For example, a 50-year-old up-and-comer named Mikhail Gorbachev has been named a voting member of the Soviet Politburo, but is limited to a role in the Secretariat for Agriculture. Brezhnev has given his regime such strength and stability that a move to oust him, short of his physical incapacitation, seems almost inconceivable, the New York Times reports. But the Soviet boss knows he must stay strong to maintain power. Now, deeply angered by Ronald Reagan's comments to Walter Cronkite, Brezhnev feels his light-hearted manner vanish. He furiously dictates a 9-page personal letter to Reagan. "The Soviet Union has not sought and does not seek superiority," he seethes, "but neither will we permit such superiority to be established over us. Such attempts, as well as attempts to talk to us from a position of strength, are absolutely futile. To attempt to win in the arms race, to count on victory in an atomic war, would be dangerous madness." Ronald Reagan receives Brezhnev's letter at the White House on March 6th. It is a Friday, and he is looking forward to a weekend at the Camp David presidential retreat for a dose of the outdoors. He knows Brezhnev, having met him at Richard Nixon's home in San Clemente, California, years ago, when he was still governor of California. World peace is contingent upon Reagan finding some way to relate to his Soviet counterpart. It is a delicate thing to know that the fate of the world hangs on your next action. "I didn't have much faith in communists or put much stock in their word," Reagan will later write. "Still, it was dangerous to continue the East-West nuclear standoff forever, and I decided that if the Russians wouldn't take the first step, I should." As he so often does in moments like these, Reagan consults with his advisors. This time, he turns to Secretary of State Alexander Haig, who has been insisting since the inauguration that he be given a more vital role in foreign affairs. Speaking in the Oval Office, Reagan suggests to Haig that it might be good for him to write Brezhnev a personal letter in reply. But Haig is appalled. He knows the Soviets well from his years in the military as NATO commander, during which he often squared off against the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact allies. In Haig's estimation, Brezhnev's letter is typical Soviet rhetoric. He suggests that Reagan allow him to draft the return letter. Ronald Reagan defers to Haig. He considers his Secretary of State his chief advisor on foreign affairs. 19 days later, on March 25th, Haig sends his draft of the letter to the White House. The date is notable because it is the same day that John Hinckley is dropped off at the airport in Denver by his mother. Also on that Wednesday, Ronald Reagan flies by helicopter to Quantico for an afternoon of horseback riding. "It felt great," Reagan writes in his journal that evening. "We should do this often." Reagan begins keeping a journal on the very first day of his presidency. He will not miss a single entry over the course of his administration. Several days after the incident, he even took the time to write about the day he was shot. As he has done so frequently over the years, Reagan uses the time astride the small brown mare to sort out his thoughts. Haig has been a nettlesome presence in the White House, constantly wheedling power where he can find it, often at the expense of Vice President George Bush. The letter that Haig has drafted reflects that temerity. Reagan considers Haig's words inflammatory and not at all diplomatic. The president sends the letter back to the State Department asking for a new draft. 5 days later, his request is fulfilled. But once again, it is not the letter Reagan has in mind. The date is March 30, 1981. Ronald Reagan has been in office 69 days, but no letter will be written that day. Instead, an act of pure evil intervenes. 19. Park Central Hotel, Washington, D.C., March 30, 1981, 9 a.m. John Hinckley is hungry. He turns off the Today Show in his AAA-approved budget hotel room and steps out onto the corner of 18th and G Street. The sky is overcast. A light rain settles on Hinckley's well-worn beige jacket as he strolls 3 blocks to the K Street McDonald's. He did not sleep well last night, troubled by how to play out his Jodie Foster obsession once and for all. Money is also on his mind. Once again, Hinckley is almost broke. After spending $47 on his room last night and then spending $1 for breakfast, he has less than $130 to his name. This is barely enough for a ticket back home to Denver, but John Hinckley does not care. He will never return to that home again. On his way to breakfast, Hinckley turns into the local Crown Books. He browses, looking for literature about his two favorite topics, the Beatles and political assassination. But little interests Hinckley this morning. He leaves the bookstore, crosses the street to McDonald's, orders an Egg McMuffin, and sits down in a booth to plan his day. Unlike most Washington tourists, Hinckley does not envisage hours of sightseeing. Instead, he will either take the train to New Haven and shoot himself dead in front of Jodie Foster, or he will murder Ted Kennedy, if only to add his name to the notorious list of assassins who have stalked and killed a member of that political dynasty. If that target is not available, he might enter the U.S. Senate chamber and try to kill as many lawmakers as possible. And there is one other scenario in Hinckley's mind: assassinating President Ronald Reagan. No matter which of the four schemes he chooses, Hinckley has the means to pull it off. Nestled within his large suitcase back at the Park Central Hotel are his snub-nosed pistol and 43 lethal bullets. Hinckley sits alone in the McDonald's for an hour. He cannot make up his mind. Shortly before 11, he walks back to the Park Central, stopping along the way to buy a copy of the Washington Star. At the same moment, 2 blocks away in the White House, President Ronald Reagan is just concluding a ceremonial 14-minute meeting in the Cabinet Room with a group of Hispanic leaders. It has been a long morning, beginning with a breakfast for his political appointees in the Blue Room at 8:34, then a 15-minute session with his top advisors. Four more meetings round out the morning, each with a cast of dignitaries and administration officials. Among them is a relatively new face, James Brady. As Reagan's recently hired press secretary, Brady has the job of dealing with the media, using wit and intelligence to get the president's message to the public. The husky Brady, a political veteran from Illinois, is 40 years old. Nancy Reagan initially opposed him for the high-profile position, thinking him too old and too heavy. But Brady's sense of humor and his candor impressed the president, and have made him popular with the Washington press corps. Brady is hoping to tighten his bond with Ronald Reagan in the coming months by spending time with him. This afternoon, Reagan is due to give a short speech at the Washington Hilton, but Brady is unsure if he will attend. The president will not be taking questions from the press, and Brady's time might be better spent at the White House. As James Brady deliberates, Ronald Reagan spends 30 minutes alone in the Oval Office tinkering with his upcoming speech. The audience will be liberal union members who oppose his politics, but Reagan is confident he can win them over with his Irish charm. Finally, at 11:24 a.m., Ronald Reagan slips out of the Oval Office and walks along the colonnade next to the Rose Garden, then takes the elevator upstairs to his private residence. There, he changes into a new blue suit before sitting down to a lunch of soup and fruit. Nancy Reagan is attending a luncheon in Georgetown, so the president dines with an old friend from California, the openly gay interior decorator, Ted Graeber. As the president eats lunch, John Hinckley is taking a shower. He is deep in thought as the water beats down on him. An item on page A4 in the Washington Star has caught his eye. Under the heading, President's Schedule, the piece mentions that Ronald Reagan will be giving a speech at the Washington Hilton this afternoon. This presents Hinckley with a dilemma. Should he murder the president or kill himself in front of Jodie Foster? He has already decided against murdering Ted Kennedy or shooting up the Senate chamber. Now, with his options down to just two, Hinckley soaks under the shower spray, trying to make up his mind. It was in the shower, he will later explain, that I debated whether to detour to the Hilton or go up to New Haven. I was thinking, should I go over to the Hilton with my little pistol and see how close I could, well, see what the scene was like? Hinckley rinses off the soap and turns off the water. His mind is made up. He is going to the Hilton. He towels off and gets dressed in a pair of simple trousers, a shirt, and ankle-high boots. His wallet contains $129 in cash, along with two library cards, a Texas driver's license, a chess club membership, and folded magazine photos of Jodie Foster. There is no guarantee he will fire his gun this afternoon, but if he does get close enough to squeeze off a round, John Hinckley wants Jodie Foster to know he is doing it for her. He sits down at a small wooden desk and composes a letter to his beloved. "Dear Jodie," he writes, "there is a definite possibility I will be killed in my attempt to get Reagan. This is why I am writing you this letter now. As you well know by now, I love you very much. Over the past 7 months, I've left you dozens of poems, letters, and love messages in the faint hope that you could develop an interest in me. Although we talked on the phone a couple of times, I never had the nerve to simply approach you and introduce myself. Besides my shyness, I honestly did not wish to bother you with my constant presence. I know the many messages left at your door and in your mailbox were a nuisance, but I felt that it was the most painless way for me to express my love for you. I feel very good about the fact that you at least know my name and how I feel about you. And by hanging around your dormitory, I've come to realize that I'm the topic of more than a little conversation, however full of ridicule it may be. At least you know that I'll always love you. Jodie, I would abandon the idea of getting Reagan in a second if I could only win your heart and live out the rest of my life with you, whether it be in total obscurity or whatever. I will admit to you that the reason I'm going ahead with this attempt now is because I cannot wait any longer to impress you. I've got to do something now to make you understand in no uncertain terms that I'm doing all of this for your sake. By sacrificing my freedom and possibly my life,
I hope to change your mind about me. This letter is being written only an hour before I leave for the Hilton Hotel. Jody, I'm asking you to please look into your heart and at least give me the chance with this historical deed to gain your respect and love. I love you forever. John Hinckley. He adds the time, 12:45 p.m., to his signature and then places the letter in an envelope. This will be left behind in his suitcase for investigators should he succeed in murdering the president. John Hinckley stands and removes the Saturday Night Special from his suitcase, along with boxes of ammunition. Several types of bullets soon litter his bedspread. Hinckley has the choice of normal, round-nosed bullets, or six rounds of an especially brutal bullet designed to blow a hole in the target by exploding on impact, spewing hot shrapnel. Appropriately, these bullets are known as devastators. He chooses them. Armed and dangerous, Hinckley then takes a cab for the short ride to the Washington Hilton. He is nervous and has to urinate, so he asks the driver to stop at the Holiday Inn across the street. Hinckley uses the restroom and then hurries back to the entrance of the Hilton. A small crowd of seven journalists and a dozen eager spectators await Ronald Reagan's arrival. A padded black rope has been hung across the sidewalk by hotel security to keep the crowd a safe distance from the president. Pistols snug in his jacket pocket, John Hinckley joins the crowd. The time is 1:46 p.m. At almost the exact same time, Ronald Reagan and his 15-vehicle motorcade depart the White House for the Hilton. Reagan's 1972 Lincoln Continental, with its backward-opening suicide doors, is nicknamed Stagecoach. The president, whose Secret Service code name is Rawhide, a reference to the westerns he loves, rides in the back seat with Secretary of Labor Raymond Donovan. Trailing behind are several limousines carrying members of the White House staff, the president's personal physician, Dr. Daniel Ruge, and a bevy of Secret Service agents. It is a 1.3-mile drive to the Hilton. Press Secretary James Brady is also in the caravan. At the last moment, he decided to make the trip in order to hear what Reagan will say. At 1:51 p.m., the presidential motorcade arrives at the Hilton. John Hinckley stands in the crowd of spectators behind the security rope, watching the motorcade approach. The main entrance of the Hilton is behind him. The president will not enter through this door. Instead, he will use the canopy-covered VIP entrance just 40 feet away. The assassin feels an unlikely burst of excitement at the prospect of seeing Reagan in person. Hinckley pats the pistol in his right pocket. Ample time at the rifle range has prepared him for what is to come. He knows the .22-caliber Rome must be fired at close range for peak accuracy, and the spot where he now stands is well within the pistol's optimal range of 90 feet. Hinckley surveys the scene, seeing ABC newsman Sam Donaldson among others. More than two dozen Secret Service agents stand ready to protect the president. Hotel security and Washington police also crowd around the Hilton, including two police officers facing the crowd on the other side of the security rope. Hinckley notices that there are some Secret Service agents on nearby rooftops. Suddenly, President Reagan's limousine glides past the security rope and comes to a halt just outside the VIP entrance. An agent steps out the front passenger door and hustles to open Reagan's door on the right rear side of the vehicle. Quickly, the president emerges into the afternoon drizzle, taking a moment to wave to the crowd. D.C. police officers Herbert Granger and Thomas Delahanty are working the security rope and should be facing toward the crowd looking for signs of trouble. Instead, they crane their necks to the left to see the president. This is the perfect time for John Hinckley to shoot. But he does not. Hesitating, he responds to the president's wave with a wave of his own. It is not an assassin's kiss, but rather the goofball motion of a confused man. "He was looking right at me and I waved back," Hinckley will recall. "I was kind of startled." In the blink of an eye, Reagan is inside the building. The time is 2:02 p.m. The president is introduced by Robert A. Georgine,
the 48-year-old head of the AFL-CIO's Building and Construction Trades Department. Reagan bounds onto the stage to the strains of Hail to the Chief, and then launches into his speech. As always, the nearsighted Reagan has removed one contact lens, which will allow him to read the printed text with one eye while scanning the crowd with the other. Ronald Reagan enjoys public speaking. It comes easily to him. He begins his speech, as usual, with a joke. John Hinckley hears laughter coming from the ballroom. He has left the security rope to step inside the Hilton and wander around the lobby. "Should I? Should I?" he asks himself repeatedly, feeling the heft of the Saturday night special in his pocket. He is having second thoughts about killing Ronald Reagan. If he were to leave right now and go back to his hotel room, nobody would be the wiser. He could burn his letter to Jodie Foster and slide the .22 caliber back into his luggage. Rather than die in a hail of Secret Service bullets or spend the rest of his life in prison, John Hinckley could simply walk away. "I just wasn't that desperate. I just wasn't that desperate to act," he will later state. "Also, it was raining, and I wasn't going to stand around in the rain." Hinckley makes up his mind. He will go back to the spectator area and wait. If Reagan does not appear in 10 minutes, Hinckley tells himself, he will leave. The time is 2:19 p.m. Ronald Reagan has 5 minutes left in his speech. Meanwhile, less than 2 miles away, Nancy Reagan is lunching at the Georgetown home of Michael Ainslie. The president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation is hosting the First Lady and the wives of several cabinet members after a brief morning tour of the Phillips Collection Museum of Art. But at 2:20 p.m., Nancy Reagan suddenly tells Secret Service agent George Opfer she is not feeling well. It's nothing specific, just a general feeling of anxiety. The worried First Lady says her goodbyes and is driven back to the White House. John Hinckley is back in the spectator area outside the Hilton. He works his way to the very front of the crowd, so that the black rope presses against his belly and his right shoulder is against the hotel's facade. Three Washington police officers stand on the other side of the rope, facing him. Hinckley later remembers that they, as well as Secret Service agents, turned away from the crowd when President Reagan appeared. The would-be assassin notices immediately that the Secret Service has moved Ronald Reagan's limousine to facilitate an easier departure from the hotel. Rather than being parked just outside the VIP entrance, it is now standing so close to the security rope that the right rear bumper almost touches the spectator area. Ronald Reagan will enter the Lincoln not 40 feet, but just 10 feet away from where John Hinckley now stands. All at once, Hinckley is jostled. Newsmen are pushing to get a better position in order to ask Reagan questions. Hinckley is outraged, shouting to the other spectators that the media should not be allowed to push their way to the front of the crowd. But then it becomes clear to him that the press is providing a vital distraction. Everyone is paying attention to the media. No one is paying attention to John Hinckley. Ronald Reagan finishes his speech at 2:24 p.m. The applause is polite, which disappoints him, for it is not the robust ovation he was hoping to hear. "Speech not riotously received," he will later write in his diary. "Still, it was successful." As part of his daily routine, Reagan places a check mark next to each item on his agenda once it is concluded. The speech to the Building and Construction Trades Department having just earned its checkmark, the president leaves the stage and immediately follows his Secret Service escort to the car. Press Secretary James Brady stands just inside the VIP door with Michael Deaver as Reagan approaches. A wave of Secret Service agents rushes past Brady, taking up their positions near the limousine. Agent Tim McCarthy is tasked with opening the right rear door for Reagan. James Brady steps out of the VIP entrance before his boss, walking next to Deputy Chief of Staff Deaver. The president has chosen not to take questions, so Brady will now speak with the reporters himself. "Deal with them," Deaver says tersely as he heads toward the car that will ferry him back to the White House. James Brady steps closer to the crowd as Ronald Reagan walks out the hotel door. Secret Service agent Jerry Parr follows one step behind. It is his job to protect the president, so he now moves slightly to Reagan's left, placing his body between him and the crowd of spectators. If something were to happen within the first few steps outside the VIP door, Parr would immediately force Reagan back inside the safety of the hotel. The first 15 feet to the presidential limousine pass without incident. Parr is no longer thinking about pulling Reagan back. Now he is focused on moving the president forward into the car. Agent McCarthy opens the right rear door of the limo. Like Press Secretary James Brady, McCarthy attended the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. In a light blue suit, the former college football player is just shy of 32. Brady stands 10 feet from him, walking quickly to the security rope to meet with the press. McCarthy stands ready to close the door behind Reagan, unsure if the president will linger to wave to the crowd before getting inside the car. The time is 2:27 p.m.